From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokine. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. Does the long-term American economic forecast call for prosperity or peril? A Wake Forest University economist will help us answer that question. Some state lawmakers want to give North Carolina voters the chance to lower the constitutional cap on state income taxes. You'll learn why. You'll also hear criticism of their plan. A nearly unanimous legislature is supporting efforts to strengthen the rules regarding use of North Carolina's rainy day savings reserve. You'll hear the details. Plus, the editor-in-chief of Carolina Journal joins us. He'll assess the North Carolina political landscape in the wake of the repeal of controversial House Bill 2. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us. She has the Carolina Journal headline.
If you haven't yet filed your North Carolina income tax forms, you've got just a couple days left before the official deadline, which is April 18th this year. Now, as you fill out those forms, one thing to make note of is that the personal income tax rate has gone down over the past several years. That's just a part of historic tax reform we're all enjoying here in North Carolina. Becky Gray is Senior Vice President with the John Locke Foundation, and she's here to give us some perspective on tax filing day. Becky, welcome back.
Taxes, yay!
Well, we don't like to talk about filing, but we do like to talk about the reform that we've seen over the past number of years. Big changes in a variety of areas. Let's talk first about the personal income tax rate.
Right. And of course, that's what everybody's paying attention to with the tax filing. Those are what we file every year, the personal income tax. And yeah, Donna, you're right. I mean, we have reduced the personal income tax in North Carolina from a three-step marginal rate where different levels of income paid different rates, which was confusing. It was not as simple. The higher income earners paid a higher rate. But what they've done is they have reduced the personal income tax to a flat rate. So everybody pays the same rate. Now, obviously, people who make more money pay more under that rate, but everybody pays the flat rate. So it is lower and it is simpler. And the flat rate is lower than any of the rates were before. So everybody who pays personal income in North Carolina now pays a lower rate than they did before. In addition to that, they have increased the standard deduction, that amount that you don't pay any taxes on right off the bat. They have increased that significantly to $17,500. So you get a bigger tax break from the very beginning. And of course, the people that are most impacted by that are low income earners.
Now, Becky, for the last number of years, as long as I can remember, we have heard people and a lot of discussion here at the John Locke Foundation about tax reform and the principles upon which that reform should take place. Some people were calling for a flat tax, and what you're describing is a flat tax.
Exactly.
We
what
now
we
have it here.
Right.
So folks may not realize that rate is lowered, but as you said, that's really helping lower income and middle income taxpayers a lot because of that zero tax bracket.
Exactly. So those are people who, in some cases, don't pay any taxes now. What these reforms have done, and some proposals moving into the new year, some things that are on the table, would move more people off the tax rolls entirely that don't pay any personal income tax. Now, of course, these are low income workers, low income earners. So they're the ones that are really receiving the benefits of that. But for all of us, it's a simpler, cleaner, lower tax rate for personal income. But let's not forget, too, they've also reduced the corporate income tax rate. They have moved some taxes off the books entirely. The death tax, the estate tax, the earned income tax credit has been moved off, replaced with, I think, a much better system under the standard deduction that we mentioned. So there's a real effort to not only reduce taxes, but make it simpler for us to understand, and also getting rid of some taxes. One thing that we know from studies is the more taxing options there are, the higher the tax burden. So part of this is not just lowering taxes, but it's simplifying things, consolidating, moving some taxes off the books entirely, allowing people to keep more of their money.
Becky, some folks might be listening to us right now and kind of scratching their head and saying, okay, well, yeah, we all want a tax reduction, but what does that mean for North Carolina's economy? What's occurred?
Well, what's occurred, and it's important to talk about this in terms of not just the tax cuts. If you're going to reduce the amount of revenue that's coming in, you've also got to reduce spending. So what we've seen is, in conjunction with lowering the tax rates, lower taxes, we've also reduced government spending, really prioritizing things, identifying what the core functions of government are, streamlining, really getting our fiscal house in order. Now, in addition to that, we've also had comprehensive regulatory reform. So we're getting regulation off the backs of businesses, entrepreneurs, citizens. That's a part of it, too. And then looking at the money that government does spend, where's that best spent? Where are the wisest investments? Where's the biggest bang for our buck, if you will? And we're seeing those investments in education. We're seeing those investments in infrastructure. So again, what you're doing is providing a well-skilled workforce for businesses who are now looking at North Carolina because we have fewer regulations. We have a lower tax base. Energy policy is something else that certainly comes into this, as we keep energy costs low. All of these things are attractive to businesses to expand, move into North Carolina, create jobs, and with job creation, we have more taxpayers. So we're seeing a real revival of our economy, a strength of our economy here in North Carolina. All of these things together, and the tax cuts is certainly a big part of that, but all of these things together have resulted in a very vibrant North Carolina economy. Donna, over 400,000 net new jobs have been created in North Carolina since we have undergone these changes that I've mentioned.
What you've mentioned is really historic tax reform. And here's the thing that some folks may not realize. I mean, this is really tough to do. We've been talking about tax reform for years and years and years in North Carolina. And these are major changes. And now other states are looking at North Carolina for the very reasons you described, saying, wow, these people really did it right. How did the legislature and the former governor get this done?
Bold leadership, basically, is what it is, and really putting their nose to the grindstone. We provided, at the John Locke Foundation, we provided a tremendous amount of data and support for those decisions. We knew that these kind of changes would work because we've seen the economic studies, we've seen academic things, we've seen some things that other states have done right, some things that other states have done wrong. So we really went back dipped back in history, across the country, looking at how things were done, made recommendations, and it did. It has taken bold leadership. And in some cases, the corporate income tax is an example of that. What we did is we put in revenue triggers to ensure that as the economy recovered, that further tax reductions, that we didn't get ahead of our headlights, if you will. So this was done very thoughtfully. It was done with a great deal of determination and with facts and data behind these decisions and these reforms. And what we've seen is it's paid off. It's worked. North Carolina is one of four states that has a revenue surplus this year, in addition to the job creation, the other things that I've mentioned. So what we're seeing moving forward is, during this budget cycle, we are seeing the General Assembly considering further tax reductions, further regulatory reductions, again, shoring up the education investments that we've made, the infrastructure investments that we've made, ensuring energy costs are low. All of these things are building on each other. And what we're seeing is a robust, growing, very vibrant economy.
Now, we know that not only are other states and other governors and legislatures looking at what we're doing and trying to replicate the formula in their own states, but we have national organizations. One in particular, the Tax Foundation, puts out rankings of tax freedom in different states, and North Carolina has basically catapulted up those lists.
We have. We've gone from 44th to 11th in the national business tax climate rankings. And the reason why this is important, again, what we want to do is we want to grow businesses in North Carolina. We want businesses to choose to come to North Carolina because of this environment that we've created, to expand their business, to grow their business, to bring headquarters, so that you have that buy-in in communities across North Carolina. This is happening. It's very exciting. I'm very proud of our work at the John Locke Foundation to be a big part of these decisions that have been made.
So as folks are looking at the last couple of days for getting those forms together, if you haven't already filed, just kind of file away a mental note that you are paying a lower personal income tax rate as part of these historic tax reforms that we've been talking about with Becky Gray, who is Senior Vice President at the John Locke Foundation. All right, Becky Gray, thank you.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Is our economic future cloudy or bright? Ask a range of pundits and prognosticators, and you're likely to get a range of answers. Today, we put that question to Robert Waples, professor of economics at Wake Forest University. He recently addressed the John Locke Foundation's Shaftesbury Society on the topic, the future, economic peril or prosperity. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So first of all, I guess that title is based on a collection of essays that dealt with this topic. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I and the other co-editors of the Independent Review asked a panel of economists, broadly defined, sort of, what's the economy, what's society going to be like 50 years from now? And as I explained in the introduction, I became a grandparent, and I was thinking, you know, what's life going to be when my granddaughter's my age, 50-ish, a little more than 50 years from now? And so when we brought them together, generally people were optimistic. So our subtitle is Economic Future, Economic Peril or Prosperity. And I guess the answer is yes. So prosperity probably, but maybe peril, because most of the authors put some caveats in, you know, that things could turn out badly, and here's how they could turn out badly.
What is it about this outlook of the future that makes them think it's probably going mm-hmm. to be good?
Mm-hmm. And I would say most simply, just look at history, right? The American economy and the global economy have been growing pretty well for a good while now. And we think we know why. We think it has something to do with a good combination of places, countries having good incentives in place, property rights, those kinds of things, stable government. But then also we give very good incentives to our innovators, especially to come up with new technology, and it's new technology that drives economic growth. And so I guess there's some ways that we could wreck that recipe, but if we keep it in place, we should continue to get the same results.
And when you're talking about incentives, we should probably make clear that this is not targeted tax incentives
or corporate
giveaways for particular businesses, but general policies that affect
so
all.
You come up with a great innovation, and you know what? You get to sell it to people all over the globe, and you can make a lot of money doing that. But the other guys might be trying to come up with these same things, and so you have to, you know, it's a little race for you to roll things out. And so who are the big winners in the process? It's actually the consumers. Studies show that in the long run, you know, something like 97% of all the benefits of these innovations go to the consumers, and a small percent, but it's still billions and billions of dollars, can go to the innovators, the producers themselves who come up with these things. So they got a great incentive to keep doing it.
Now, you mentioned that most of the authors who contributed to the symposium had at least some caveats. Mm-hmm. What are some of the key things that could help lead to peril rather than prosperity?
Yeah. And so, you know, I think at the top of the list, there's a couple of things. One big one is what we'll call regulatory kudzu. It grows like this vine, does regulation, right? And it can just suffocate you eventually. And we, you know, we've been through a regulatory upheaval recently. And unless we start clipping that vine away, we could have some pretty bad results. Another thing, of course, that people are worried about is that we've got these open-ended entitlements, especially for programs like Social Security, all those health care things. And so the U.S. government, we know, has been running up bigger and bigger debts. There's lots of countries around the world that have followed this same path. And history shows that, you know, once the debt level gets past a certain point, that starts to put a good damper on growth as well, or bad damper on growth as well. Okay, you know, there's other worries that people have. I'll throw in one of my worries, I guess two of my worries, that I brought out in my editor's introduction. And the first of those was we've really seen a progressive decline of the family in you know, recent generations. Look at my statistics here. In 1959, 5% of children were born out of wedlock. Now the number is about 53%, more than half, right? And we've seen what Nicholas Eberstadt calls the global flight from the family. Not just men going like, well, I don't need to raise any kids, but like women starting to be like this as well. And so the question is, you know, are children going to be raised with, from an economic point of view, enough human capital, but from a cultural, social point of view, just in a stable environment so that they can be people who learn how to take care of themselves and learn how to support somebody else and not just be a ward of the state or something for a long, long time. Okay. And the other big worry that I raise in my introduction is, I'll call it complacency. Complacency is, in economic terms, a normal good. The richer you get, the more you can afford to be complacent. We're getting rich, and we can afford to be complacent. And we're really getting complacent, I think, about the growth of government. And it slowly, sometimes rapidly, taking away our freedoms. And, you know, new generations are coming on, and I, you know, worry about the future. People just won't even know what freedom is and what freedom is meant for. Those are my big worries.
We are chatting with Robert Waples, professor of economics at Wake Forest University, also one of the co-editors of this new collection, Future: Economic Peril or Prosperity. You were mentioning that the people who were approaching this were looking 50 years out so. There's a lot of thought at this point about, okay, forget 50 years. Mm-hmm. What are things going to look like for the next few years with this brand new administration, a complete change from what we've seen over the past 8 years in the U.S.? As you're looking at what our incoming raft of politicians are looking at, what are some of the things you want to see that would suggest to you that we're going on the right path instead of where we have been in recent years?
Well, I personally have been pleased so far in what I've seen in terms of, you know, nominees for cabinet positions and those kind of things, and that these are not fans of continued growth of government. They're going to sit back and they're going to take a very sober look at government programs that have grown too much out of control and, you know, are giving people all the wrong incentives and therefore need to be pruned back. And so obviously we see this with the big healthcare overhaul. We'll see how easy it is to undo that. But there's just regulations all over the place. That's the tip of the iceberg. In many ways, one of the biggest problems we've seen recently is a decline in labor force participation by able-bodied adults. And it's because there's so many programs in place that disincentivize you from going out and, you know, taking care of yourself. Something happened, you lost your job, and so you're now eligible for all these programs. And it's almost like a glue trap, you know, and you just can't pull yourself out of it. And, you know, that's one of the main things. It's just putting all these people that could be potentially very productive, just putting them on the sidelines and not able to tap into all of their great abilities. So.
Well, our time is short, but to encapsulate what we've discussed, it sounds as if the overall outlook is pretty good, as long as we don't fall into some of these traps. Is that a good way of looking at it?
Yeah. You know, if we can continue to solve our problems as we have in the past, we should be able to see continued rise in prosperity in the United States. And so people will look back 50 years from now, hopefully, and say, what were they worrying about? Just like we look back, the people 50 years ago, they had worries. You know, we were like, whew, what were they worrying about? We didn't end up facing those problems.
Well, that is a good place to end the conversation. That is the voice of Robert Waples, professor of economics at Wake Forest University, also co-editor of the book Future Economic Peril or Prosperity. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
Are you looking to make North Carolina more free? The John Locke Foundation is, and here are three things you can do today to help us make it happen. First, know the facts. Visit johnlocke.org for data, analysis, interviews, and more. And read carolinajournal.com to learn what government is doing with your money. Second, influence the debate. Invest in the John Locke Foundation's work with a tax-deductible donation. You can get it done in less than 90 seconds at johnlocke.org. And third, make North Carolina more free by sharing the message of freedom. It's easy when you visit johnlocke.org. Click on shareables, download, pass the messages of freedom to your friends, print the messages and mail them. Or if you're a savvy computer user, share the message of freedom on Facebook and Twitter. Know the facts, influence the debate, and share the message. Three things you can do today to help us make North Carolina more free. Get started today at johnlocke.org.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today, buy something nice, and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokine. The state Senate wants to give North Carolina voters the chance to set a new limit on state income taxes. A constitutional amendment would set that limit at 5.5%. That's just above the state's current tax rate. Republican Ralph Heise explains the plan.
This is a one opportunity that we're giving to a ballot measure to say that we're going to put a real control on government and its authority to take your funds. But the fear of this is that people know that this is what the citizens of our state want. 6% cap passed overwhelmingly in Georgia. And there's a fear that this cap will pass overwhelmingly in the state of North Carolina. When you give people the choice of what their tax rate can be, I think they'll generally always choose a lower number. Maybe that gives you how they feel about most of our spending.
Democrats like Senator Floyd McKissick oppose a new limit on income taxes.
What we do with this bill is to limit those options. In a way, it's kind of disguising it with smoke and mirrors, because it really sounds perhaps good to someone to say, hey, it's never going to be more than 5.5%. But do you tell them at the same time, in transparency and honesty, Well, if we've got to get that money in, if it doesn't come from these other sources and we don't know if it'll be there or not, it means that maybe up to 160 categories in goods and services may be taxed. Or that you may see your sales taxes go up to 10, 12, 14%. Because if you told them that in honesty and let them sit back and understood the complexities of the issues that we face, they may not be so quick to jump at a simplistic solution.
Republican Senator Andy Wells responded to McKissick's concerns.
We're not limiting options. We're not limiting choices. We're not setting a rate on an income tax cap. We're allowing the public to have a voice. We're going to the public. And I'm sure there will be a campaign and the public will have hear every disaster scenario that could possibly happen from the broadcast media and the newspaper editorial pages. They won't lack for negative information, but they'll have a chance to make a choice. Some members are confident they will make the right choice. Some members are scared to death those voters will make the right choice. But I'm confident in the voice of the voters.
That's Senator Andy Wells. He and his colleagues voted 36-13 to let North Carolinians decide whether the state should lower its limit on state income taxes. The idea needs support from the state house to reach the ballot. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Are you tired of fake news? Well, you won't find it here. At Carolina Journal, we don't make things up and we don't presume or assign motives. There's no simpler way to put it than that. We're proud to say that honest, factual, rigorous journalism is the Carolina Journal way. Our reporting team is focused on accountability in government and policymaking, no matter which political party is in power and regardless of the person taken to task in the story. At Carolina Journal, we're beholden to the truth and to transparency. Unlike fake news, lies, innuendo, questionable sourcing, all meant to create controversy, not inform the debate. So the next time you're confronted with fake news, log on to CarolinaJournal.com or pick up the latest print edition. You'll find compelling news reporting from a team that knows what it means to be real journalists, committed to truth. Carolina Journal, you can count on us for the facts.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Plans are moving forward to set new rules in place governing use of North Carolina government's Rainy Day Savings Reserve Fund. Nelson Dollar is the State House's chief budget writer. He explained the idea to colleagues.
It takes North Carolina from, frankly, one of the weaker savings regiments of any state to what the Pew Center believes and has analyzed will be one of the strongest. What we are doing in this legislation is creating a savings deposit rule that is actually tied to revenue growth. In the past, there was no real connection there in any real tangible way. Defines clear objectives and conditions for use of the fund. That, again, was a weakness in North Carolina. We were really only one of six states that really had no definition for that. This bill puts very clear definitions around that. It establishes an evidence-based fund savings target, so you're not just picking a number out of the air, but you actually have a rationale behind developing what that savings target needs to be. And in this case, the idea is to build that fund, not build it too much, but build it so that we can withstand 9 out of 10 two-year budgetary calamities. So and when you think back and look at, for example, I guess it was 08, 09, in that time frame, revenues from where they were projected to where they came in dropped over $3.3 billion. And I know that some of the members who were here then, some of them that were in leadership then, had some incredibly difficult decisions that they had to make. And there was very little outside of what came from the federal government to help out with that scenario.
Some colleagues wanted even tighter restrictions. Republican Representative Mark Brody offered an amendment. It would force lawmakers to approve a separate bill anytime they want to use rainy day reserves.
When you mix certain things together, you can have detrimental effects. And for example, just in chemistry, you mix ammonia and chlorine, you can get some pretty nasty stuff. Well, in life too, in politics, I think you can do the same thing. You have an entity called a large sum of money, and on the other end, you have a room full of politicians. And so what I believe is that sometimes can create problems because sometimes the politicians want to get at the money. So although the process was set up to get at it, I'm saying that in this particular case, it would help us out by making it transparent. That way, everybody can see, including the public, can see what we're taking out. Remember, this is a special fund. This wasn't something that just was put out there. This is something created for a purpose. And I think we owe the public the opportunity to view what we are doing in the process of going through committees and hearings and on the floor of this House and on the Senate.
Representative Michael Speciale supported Brody's plan.
While it might make it a little bit harder for the gentleman to put the budget together, he's going to have to go through a couple extra steps. It certainly makes it much more transparent. It makes it much easier to control. And it does limit how much can be spent so that you can't take it and spend it all at once on other programs. I mean, we set this up for a reason, and let's protect it. I think this amendment does that. It protects it for the purposes that we had intended to, and it certainly doesn't restrict it from being used to fill a shortfall, but it does restrict it from being from us emptying out the bank because we want all kinds of other programs and things to spend money on.
The House overwhelmingly rejected the amendment. A couple of lawmakers objected to the bill itself. One was Democratic Representative Billy Richardson.
I respect what you're doing. We did it in 92. It's so crucial that we have a rainy day fund. I commend this assembly for us being responsible with the money. It's just so important. But process matters. Process matters. And respect for the other branches of government matter. And the two things I would say, and the reason I cannot support this is not worth the paper it's written on. This is politics over substantive law. We are taking a very noble thing, and that's saving money, and we're politicizing it. We're bragging. Look at what we're doing. We're making it a law saying this is how it's got to be. When we've made the law to begin with, we don't need to do this. People know that we're a responsible assembly. People know that the Republican Party is a party of responsibility. We don't need to do this. We need to work on education. We need to work on environment. We need to work on collegiality between us. We need to go forward, not backwards. And this is not what is going to make us a better assembly.
Richardson specifically objected to a measure that forces the governor to set aside some funds in his budget for savings.
There's a permissible statute giving the governor guidance on how he does his budget. We have changed a very important rule or word in that permissive thing in 143. We have taken it from may to shall. Now, if I was the governor, and we're an American, we have separation of powers, I would guard that word very cautiously. And I think when we take that oath that says we are going to defend the Constitution of North Carolina, changing that word from shall or from may to shall is a very, very significant thing. And it's something that we're insulting the governor on, and it's something we should do.
Democrat John Autry of Mecklenburg County also raised concerns.
I certainly appreciate the efforts of this body and its commitment to putting money aside for a rainy day fund to respond to nature, to arson, to hard times and economic downturns. That's very commendable. I appreciate that. And I also like the words of taking care of the future, our children and our grandchildren, which I'm lucky enough to have children and grandchildren. My concern about this bill is that we're not putting aside the proper resources to address what is the cause of a lot of the issues that we want to address by putting the rainy day fund aside, and that is climate change. it would be irresponsible for us to take this step and not put like resources aside to address the effects and the cause of climate change.
Despite the objections, all but a handful of lawmakers in both parties sided with people like Republican Representative Dean Arp.
This is a common sense and bold bill that puts into law strong financial principles of good government and fiscal discipline. This is about accountability to our children and being responsible with what we've been blessed with a look to the future. If we do not save for future economic downturns, we will have to possibly cut vital and important government functions. This bill attempts to avoid that situation. If we save responsibly now, we can have the peace of mind knowing that we won't have to make those tough decisions later on, those tough decisions that cut those vital government services that we all believe in. Saving for the future is a basic financial principle that we teach our children. So we ought to practice it in state government as well.
You've been listening to debate about a bill to set new rules in place for use of North Carolina's Rainy Day Savings Reserve Account. We'll return to Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups all across the state, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com, one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal Radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, plus opinion pieces and reports on higher education, all of that from the Pope Center for Higher Education Policy, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all of that, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina, spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Log on today. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. After a little bit more than a year of controversy and debate over House Bill 2, the so-called bathroom bill, legislators and Governor Roy Cooper reached a deal, and it was just in time to meet a deadline set by the NCAA, which had threatened to not bring college events to North Carolina as long as House Bill 2 was the law. But now, the repeal of that law may not really be the end of things. Rick Henderson is the editor-in-chief of Carolina Journal. Carolina Journal, of course, following this story very closely. Rick, welcome back.
Thanks, Donna.
Why isn't this over?
Well, it's partially not over because there still is at least one lawsuit pending in federal court about North Carolina's handling of anti-discrimination laws, primarily against transgendered persons. And so that lawsuit continues even though the motivating legislation is now gone. And so what we don't know right now is whether or not that the lawsuit, the federal government, for instance, decides not to defend the position that it did under the Obama administration, and that sort of complicates things for the ACLU and the other parties who brought the lawsuit. But still, it's not completely over yet. It's also not completely over yet because a lot of the left-wing groups that were very much opposed to HB2 were also opposed to the resolution that passed the General Assembly because they say it doesn't go far enough. They wanted the General Assembly not only to repeal HB2, but also to implement a law statewide that would guarantee all of the anti-discrimination, civil rights, set-asides, facilities changes and things like that that Charlotte had put into its local ordinance that was effectively repealed by HB2.
Anybody happy with this?
The business community is fairly happy with it. The General Assembly leadership is very happy with it because they're glad to have it off their plate now and not have to deal with it anymore. I think most of the sports organizations and boosters of these of sports teams and people who operate facilities that were having events that were rescheduled allegedly because of HB2, are happy to get those events back now, or at least to be able to bid for them again. They couldn't even bid for these events as long as these bans were in effect.
That brings up the NCAA, the ACC, the NBA. All of those organizations had something to say about this along the way. This deal that was reached between the legislature and the governor came right before the NCAA had issued a deadline of sorts, saying, if you don't do something about it, since we don't like it, our board doesn't like it, you're not going to be in the hopper for any of these events. Some people reacted to that by saying, well, why would the legislature and the governor accede to some sort of a threat from those organizations? Is that what they did, or were they acting in the best interest of the state?
Well, they were doing both, actually. The House Speaker Tim Moore sort of joked that that the NCAA's deadline and to explain the deadline, the board was planning to meet during the men's Final Four basketball tournament to decide the cities that would be allowed to bid for championship events from 2019 through 2022. The deadline was basically during the Final Four. They subsequently postponed that board meeting for a few days after the HB2 repeal went through and North Carolina, of course, got back in the hopper again for all that. But Tim Moore said afterward, well, the NCAA didn't really have anything to do with it so much, but that if you've got the votes to pass something as controversial as this, you get it out there as quickly as you can until the votes fall apart. And certainly that had something to do with it. The other thing that had to do with it was the fact that whatever you think about House Bill 2, regardless of the merits of the bill, the problems with the bill, it had gotten to the point where House Bill 2, whatever was in it, didn't really matter. It was on the books. And because the narrative around the nation was, because North Carolina passed House Bill 2, North Carolina is a state full of bigots. At some point, the perception becomes reality. And so by repealing House Bill 2, the state at least was able to get that perception out of the way, or be able to talk through it at least.
And legislators then able to move on to other pressing issues, such as developing a state operating budget and all sorts of other pieces of legislation.
Right.
Have we heard anything from the other sports leagues, the ACC, the NBA, any of those folks?
The ACC, even before the NBA, before the NCAA said that it would reconsider bringing North Carolina back, the ACC almost immediately said, okay, we're back. Of course, they're headquartered in Greensboro. The big event for the state is the ACC men's basketball tournament, which was moved was already going to be played in Brooklyn for 3 years. This was the first year, but then again, it was up in the air as to where it was going to go after that. And so now, most likely, what will happen is that Greensboro or Charlotte will be hosting the ACC men's tournament 2 out of 3 years, let's say.
And speaking of Brooklyn, some empty seats.
Yes.
In Brooklyn.
Well, yeah, because there's really no home team there. Syracuse is ostensibly the home team, but it's several hundred miles away. So that was one of the issues as well, is that it's difficult to get people to come to an area for an arena, even as spectacular as the one at Brooklyn apparently is, for an event that really doesn't involve anybody who plays nearby. Now, as for the NBA, which moved the All-Star game that was supposed to be held this year from Charlotte to New Orleans, the 2019 location for the NBA All-Star Game has not been announced, and apparently Charlotte is going to be back in the running to host that again.
This got a lot of attention, obviously, but there were at least a few state legislators who seemed to be a little bit miffed, that they felt that really it was undue pressure from particularly the NCAA. They started looking at the nonprofit status of the NCAA. Tell us about that.
Yes, there was a provision that is still under consideration in the General Assembly that would look into whether or not an organization such as the NCAA, which is set up as a nonprofit under federal tax rules, actually should have the ability to lobby legislative bodies or public deliberative bodies to try to get a certain outcome, and whether or not they should be able to do that if they have tax-exempt nonprofit status. More than likely, such moves are going to be problematic, because nonprofits actually can lobby governmental entities to get on certain issues if those issues are determined to be part of the core operation of the foundation or the organization. For instance, if there was something to deal with the nonprofit status of religious organizations and churches, churches most certainly could lobby to prevent that from happening because it has something very fundamentally to do with them. The NCAA's argument in this case would be protecting fundamental civil rights is something that is an issue that's very important to us because all of our institutions have to abide by those federal guidelines. Now, of course, in the case of House Bill 2, the question was, is gender identity something that's protected by federal law? And that still hasn't been resolved
yet. That's probably going to the Supreme Court.
That's right. The Supreme Court's probably going to be taking that issue up. But in this case, it would be very difficult for a nonprofit status of, let's say, a sports organization to be singled out for specific treatment on specific issues like this. Nonetheless, the issue of economic bullying, as it's been called, is something that's really worth looking into and something that I think there's a little bit of backlash against. You see this in the content on the different sports networks and things like that. Pushback, possible lost revenues from advertisers and also possible lost viewership of these stations.
Because the question then, I think, for any state, not just North Carolina, is what is potentially next if a sports league doesn't like something that a state legislature has done? No matter what it is, it could be something considered progressive, something considered conservative. Who's next, essentially?
That's right. That's right. And not just sports organizations, but sort of any sort of nonprofit or membership organization could be involved in activities like that.
We've been talking to Rick Henderson. He is the editor-in-chief of Carolina Journal. Thank you, Rick.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. We hope you'll come back again next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.